Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratbold, Judge Ross, and Judge Schmidt, the Honorable Diane B. Bratbold presiding.
Good morning. Let's all be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is November 1st, 2023. We have a total of six matters on our calendar this morning. Four of those will be argued orally. And I see the attorneys are here for the first case and seated at council table, so I will ask the marshal to call the first case.
Calling case A220054, State of Minnesota Respondent versus Devin Griffin Sievers Appellant.
All right, and I have just a few remarks. Thank you, counsel, for going to the podium, and you will be welcome in just a few seconds to begin. First of all, again, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We look forward to having a conversation with the attorneys this morning. I just want to remind you of a few things, probably things you're well aware of, but just to make sure. First of all, before you start your remarks, would you please identify yourself as well as the client you represent? Now, we do that because we do maintain a recording of today's proceedings while this matter is also being live streamed. The recording that we maintain is an audio recording, and it's available on the court's website, so it helps our record if you identify yourself and your client. And second, I will ask you to keep an eye on the clock. It should be visible in front of you on the podium, and it tends to go quickly during our conversation. We look forward to it. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Devon Sievers. This appeal raises the issues of insufficient evidence of venue to support the conviction, a Brady violation, and the failure to disclose crucial child protection records relating to the element of venue, and the improper denial of advisory counsel by the district court before trial. The position on venue in this case took shape by the evidence that was submitted at trial, in which it was established during the opening questioning of the victim in this case, Child A. She, in January of 2021, lived at her mother's. This was the conclusion drawn expressly in the district court's post-conviction order and taken by a respondent in this appeal. But I'm here today to just try to make the record straight that that's an incomplete summary of the record. It was established that Child A ran away from that home on January 19th of 2021, and that she went to live at the home of her friend, which was just across the river in Benton County, Child B.
Went to live or stay at?
The concept, the definition of residence that I'm dealing with and putting forward here is that she was living there. She did not intend to go back to her mother's.
But the way she described it is she was staying at her friend's after she ran away.
Yes, that word was used. But we have to talk about, in this case, what a residence means.
Am I correct that the time gap is pretty short between the time she ran away and the time of the sex assault here?
Yes. It was 5 days prior. However, what I have tried very much to do is state the complete record here. I mean, a key portion of which I think Mr. Sievers was denied at trial. See, it wasn't just that she was a wishy-washy runaway. It was established during her testimony that it was about the 20th time that she ran away. And it was also established
I'm trying to figure out how that helps. If she ran away, from her mother's home 20 times, but then was returned to that location 20 times.
The difference I see.
Doesn't that suggest that that's the residence?
Well, the difference that I see here is that when she was found at Child B's home on January 27th, she was not taken back to her mother's because there was a court order that she be removed from that home. And she was taken to some facility in Stearns County at that point. So I am putting forth here that January 19th represents a break, that she left home and she left for good, and that the finding that she intended to keep living there is erroneous.
But the placement wasn't here's where you're going to stay for good. It was a CHIPS proceeding, wasn't it?
Are you referring to the placement after January 27th?
I'm referring to the placement you were just referring to after she
right.
was taken, yes.
No, you're right, but that's what the January 20th emergency protection order says, that while her disposition is figured out, she was to live with some suitable caregiver, a relative, a designated one under 257B, something like that. But
so how does that matter as to where she was before, at the time of the assault?
Only that she was a runaway. She was basically a fugitive from her parents' unsafe home. That's another thing that the January 20th order establishes. And that's where it got to the point here where there's just no express statutory definition or law about this for a criminal case. Now, if I could talk about State v. Rucker. So State v. Rucker, I mean, went a long way towards interpreting the venue statute for child abuse cases. But the court came up just to establish that, you know, the venue can be either where the child resided when the abuse occurred or when it was discovered. Now, the venue statute itself actually says where the child resided when it was where it occurred or when she was found. So there's like these three elements in place here. I think that just for today, I don't think I expressly put it this way in my brief, it seems to me that the 627.15 statute was actually intended for a scenario like this. Some victims of child abuse are teenage runaways, but the issue of residence is something that even Rucker recognized wasn't ever defined by the legislature, and the Rucker court didn't actually do it. So I turn to the MJH decision. Yes, even though that was a child custody case, the Supreme Court had to answer the same question because it was part of the appeal. The mother was saying, well, if she goes and spends all that extra time with her father, that's going to change her residence. So our Supreme Court said, well, the legislature has never actually defined a child's residence. So they looked at 518.003. So did I. And that comes about as close as we can get. I know that the post-conviction court and respondent take strong issue with the notion that that definition and the child custody statutes can be, as respondent said, imported here. But I must assert here now, maybe for the last time, that the element of venue was an essential element, and that where the child resided, as Rucker found, is the crucial part of that element. So I don't think this issue can be decided in a vacuum.
I'm kind of in a swamp a bit, up to my knees, trying to figure out how much of this is a fact question and how much of it is a question of law.
Well, I would say that it's both, Your Honor. I think that the state, you know, sort of glossed over what happened during Child A's direct testimony. It was Mr. Severs in his cross-examination who established that when she left on January 19th, she wasn't just a runaway, but she was gone. And of course, his pretrial arguments are filled with that.
She intended not to return?
She intended not to return.
That's sort of the nature of runaways, right? Isn't that always the case?
Well, except that she went back 20 times. I mean, I don't know why they didn't go into why or how when she ran away those previous 20 times she was brought back. Maybe she was brought back against her will. Maybe she went back willingly. I don't know. She was a child.
Right, and she's still a child.
Yes, she is.
So isn't there sort of an assumption that this is still her home, even though she left? She left without the consent of her mother. I mean, she didn't have the authority as a child to leave. Can a child choose residence, or is it up to the parent?
The case law that I presented shows that if a child is either a runaway, which was explored in the Berg case about who would have jurisdiction, or is simply staying periodically with someone else, the Bierke case, that a child's residence can and does change. And see, that's what I think.
Are there cases like this one, though, where you have a runaway where the parent is still asserting the child's residence?
Right.
What does the case law say in that circumstance? Whose will determines residence? Is it the child's determination or the parent's determination before custody has been removed from the parent?
So there is no case law on that exact point. But that's why I go back to the January 20th order. Even if Child A's mother wanted her back, she couldn't. There was a court order in place.
But that was later.
Well, it was January 20th.
After the assault?
No, that's before, Judge. The assault, the child abuse, was January 24th and 25th.
Right.
There was an order in place. See, that's how Mr. Seavers knew about it during his pretrial hearings, saying that's relevant and material information. It's supposed to be turned over to me. It is. Her residence in Stearns County was temporarily, but definitively, severed with that January 20th order. She couldn't live at her mother's house. So
is there case law to support that?
Pardon?
Is there case law to support that proposition?
No, as I just said, there is not. I'm just talking about the effect of this order and what the legal effect of it is, that she couldn't live at her mother's. So unless she was going to live on the street in Stearns County, she was living under the roof of Child B's house in Benton County.
But, Counsel, didn't that order say she's going to be taken into custody of a Stearns County? So even if we agree with that point that she couldn't return to her mother's house, the order says she's going to go into Stearns County custody and live somewhere.
I can't recall that specific language. I think what I saw was that there was just a directive that she be picked up as soon as possible. As it turned out, she was picked up in Benton County. But since the order was issued by the Stearns County Juvenile Court, she was brought back to Stearns County.
And so isn't that then evidence of residence, that it is still Stearns County, even if she can't go back to her mom's house, that a Stearns County is going to pick her up and bring her back?
Well, I think that would be how and why I brought in the concept of in loco parentis to this argument, because the post-conviction court was taking issue with the notion that Child B's mother, was permitting her to live there, and made the assumption, which is not supported in the record, that she disapproved of it. Well, see, that's not a fact. The fact is that Child A was there for 8 days, and that Child B was equivocal in answering the question about how the police found out about it.
How does that bear? I mean, that might have something to say about Benton County, but how does that bear on the, I mean, if you're relying upon the emergency removal order, aren't you then stuck with the placement, the residence location of the placement that results from that order?
Not that I can see, but that's because of the venue statute. It's about at the time the abuse occurred, or when it was discovered, or when the child was found. All three of those events occurred while the child was living in Benton County. They did. The mother testified that she discovered the Facebook posts about the hotel incident on the Monday. That was January 25th. She found them later in the day. Child A had been returned home that morning. So it was discovered while she was in Benton County. She was found in Benton County. She was living in Benton County. The incident itself occurred in Hennepin County. Look, I certainly didn't see this coming. But again, I think this is why the 627.15 statute was written. Because sometimes a runaway will be living somewhere else, whether it's a week or a month, and they get abused. Well, that's where they're living. They're not living in the abusive home they just left. I just think that's a very simple and clear-cut concept, and it's reinforced by this removal order.
How would public policy bear? I mean, if we were to write an opinion on this theory published, make it precedential, do you have any public policy concerns that predators may then target runaways because of the amorphous nature. This, you know, this person's left their home. They don't intend on returning home. I'm going to take the person to someplace, as in this case, where the victim cannot recall or doesn't know exactly what county they're in. Isn't that a problem when it comes to applying the venue statute in that fashion?
Well, no, respectfully. And I think the Krejci court addressed that, because there the little child was, they took him to an ER in Hennepin. Again, I think the public policy concern you raise is addressed by the statute and the way that Rucker and Krejci addressed how it's supposed to be liberally and loosely interpreted. I think given that premise, it's not likely at all that defendants would somehow scheme to cause confusion about where the case should be prosecuted. It's about as open-ended as it can get. It's just, I think it intersects.
Let me offer a hypothetical. So let's say a predator finds a juvenile online. The juvenile runs away. The predator picks up the juvenile, takes the juvenile to a location unknown to the juvenile, sexually abuses the juvenile, and then drops the juvenile off at home.
But that would be where the child was discovered. That would answer the question. That's why, and all of these scenarios have been addressed either by the statute or Rucker. Mm-hmm. It's just nobody ever decided to say what a child's residence is, and the Supreme Court in MJH recognized that the adult residence definitions, which are replete, can't apply. They're the ones that distinguished it, because a child is dependent, but only on the person providing routine daily care and control, which arguably was happening at Child B's house, and she was there for 8 days. If the mother wanted her gone, it would have happened a lot sooner before that. Child B testified that her mother understood that Child A was a runaway, presumably, therefore, from an unsafe house. Child B's mother had responsibility. This aligns with the Bierke case. I realize that the scenario is unprecedented, that there may be a necessity of a rule of law to issue with this opinion, but it would be that a dwelling is where you live, even if you're a child. And if you're a runaway, then that place where you're living is where there's routine daily care and control. I'm out of time. I would just say this is why the Brady evidence, or was Brady evidence, it was so crucial to the element. Perhaps I can address the advisory council issue on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. And yes, you do have 5 minutes for rebuttal. And if you'd like to touch on the other issues you briefed, of course, the court welcomes that. So counsel for respondent, we're ready for you when you are ready.
May it please the court. Counsel, good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. Just want to cover a couple of things. The allegation is made, or the claim is made in the brief, and again here in oral argument, that the victim, quote, did not intend to go back to her mother's home. There is no evidence in the record that supports that. In her testimony, she never testified that she was moving out or that she intended that she would never come back. Instead, she testified that the vast majority of her belongings were still in her bedroom at her mother's home. So there's no evidence that shows
that would be the case for any, you know, a juvenile runaway is by, I think, necessity going to leave most of her belongings at the home from which she's fleeing. So why does that matter?
I'm just pointing out that's evidence that supports that she did intend to go back, or she didn't intend to leave permanently. I'm just responding to the allegation made by appellant that she did not intend to go back. There's no evidence that supports that. As far as...
Do you agree that this is a case of first impression when it comes to the definition of resides in this context?
Yes, I couldn't find anything that that was specifically on point.
If we were to agree with the state's position, what would be the precedential point of law that we would be establishing then?
As you alluded to earlier, Your Honor, it's kind of a quagmire of a legal question and a factual question. The factual question, I don't think, needs any further elaboration. It's what was the evidence presented by the state to establish venue? That's just simply either they met that or not, and here there was direct evidence. The issue seems to come up, or the point that seems to be pressed by appellant is that when the victim said she was living at her mother's home in January of 2021, that living at, her use of that phrase, living at, was not legally correct. That was just more of a colloquialism. So as far as the factual part of it, I don't think that requires anything new. But the definition of residence, I think it's curious that when appellant cites to 518.003, as I point out in my brief, in 518.003, there is a definition of residence. The only reason that In Re MJH went to the definition cited by appellant is because it was a custody issue. But in that statute, there is a definition of residence, and it aligns very closely with what the district court did here. At the end of the day, on the standard of review, it's just, did the district court abuse its discretion? And I don't believe that the district court did. I don't think you have to make a new pronouncement here. You can simply affirm what the district court did without further venturing out into what the definition should be.
Well, help me out, counsel. So it seems to me that based on our case law, we need to consider whether the Child A's residence, what was Child A's residence, correct?
Correct.
All right. So what's the law that guides our analysis on that?
Well,
because, I mean, you told me it was a question of first impression, so I'm a little confused by your answer that we don't need to clarify that.
It's a question of first impression because we have a situation where there's a runaway and there has been a ex parte court order. That's what makes this unique.
You're talking about the emergency removal order?
Yes.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay.
That's so, what makes this
so you,
unique.
So you think it is only a question of first impression as to facts, not as to law?
Correct.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This
factual situation has not come up that I'm aware of. But as Your Honor pointed out, all that order did was transfer legal custody temporarily to Stearns County. So that I don't see how that helps establish that venue was proper in Benton County.
Why isn't that a legal question then? That part of it, of, you know, your first impression acknowledgement, why doesn't it go to more than just the facts if we have to discern what is, I'm not advocating necessarily that we have a precedential opinion, but one way or the other, I think both counsel have asserted that this is a unique situation where you've got the mother who has still parental rights, the child who has left the home, and now you have this emergency order. What is the residence in that circumstance seems to be a question that might be driven by law and not just fact.
I'm naturally reluctant to go step out on a plank, but I would be fine with this court saying that the emergency order that transferred legal custody to Stearns County. I would be fine with this court saying that that established that her residence was in Stearns County. I think there's a legal, you could support that.
But the order establishes that the residence is in Stearns County based upon I mean, I thought the position you might take is that that order doesn't affect residence if it's a temporary order for placement of the child during an investigation of concerns of what's happening in the household.
I'm simply responding to the argument made by appellant that that order severed the residence because the mother could no longer have custody of her. Assuming that's true, well, what's the end result? Well, legal custody has been transferred to Stearns County. I don't see how that moves the ball down the field as far as appellant's argument that venue should have been in Benton County. My argument is she was still a resident of Stearns County because she still believed her home was at her mother's place. That's what she testified to. That's what's controlling here. But if we're going to look to other definitions, I think the definition in 518.003 of residence can be incorporated. I don't think it should be incorporated because I don't think these are in paramateri. But under subdivision 9, residence means the place where a party has established a permanent home from which the party has no present intention of moving. That seems to fit this case to a T, but that's not the definition that appellant wants you to apply. But again, at the end of the day, the issue before the court is whether the post-conviction court abused its discretion, and based on the evidence and the case law in front of it, I don't believe that it did. I want to briefly touch on the in loco parentis argument that appellant makes. In the reply brief, appellant notes that the SS testified that she was a welcome guest there. SS is a minor. She was 14 years old at the time. I don't think SS's statement that she was welcome, I don't think that is a factor that really comes into play in the in loco parentis. As far as the discovery, I think I've...
No, but just to be clear, my understanding was it wasn't just the child, the friend of the victim, but also the parent that welcomed the victim into her home.
Well, the mother never testified, and the SS testified initially that her mother called the police to report that the victim was there. She later said, well, maybe it was my brother, maybe it was somebody else. But that's an inconsistency, and that is a fact question for the finder of fact, in this case, the jury, to make. If she called the police, to me, that's an indication that, well, she may have been welcome for a night or two, but here we are 5 days later, she's no longer welcome. So when she became welcome and when she became unwelcome, that's unclear, but we do know that at some point...
Doesn't it matter how she was welcome? I mean, I might welcome someone into my house for a day or two or three, but that doesn't mean they're residing. I haven't welcomed them to be a resident of my house, but to occupy it for a period of time until they return to their own home.
People you invite over for Thanksgiving dinner and overstay their welcome. That's exactly an issue that we don't have evidence on that here, and I think appellant is reading a lot into these facts that we simply don't have with respect to what did the mother of SS say? What did she know? What did she tell the victim in this case? Those are all unanswered questions. And I think those are questions that need to be answered if appellant's argument is going to go forward. On the Brady claim, I don't want to regurgitate what's in my brief, but I think the post-conviction court's findings are well supported by the record, and the conclusions of law are consistent with precedent. I don't think there's any grounds for this court to find that that was an abuse of discretion. And the advisory council, the case law is very clear. The district court is not obligated to appoint advisory council. And if you read all those pretrial hearings, you read those transcripts, Judge Welty is bending over backwards to try and keep him with his public defender, and explains, I think he, as I note in my brief, he cites to case law, he cites to Rule 5.04, and he's telling him, this is what may happen if you go forward. Yet appellant persisted in, wanting advisory counsel, wanting a 2-week continuance, but he wasn't going to waive his 60 days. Yeah, he just seemed to be wanting to keep a perfect storm of different constitutional rights and force the court into doing something that he wanted the court to do. But I think the court handled this as well as a court could with a recalcitrant defendant. And I don't think the court abused its discretion when it accepted his waiver and then declined to appoint advisory counsel. There are no other questions.
I guess I have one other question for you, counsel. I can tell you're not favoring, I think I'm correct about this, so you can tell me if I'm wrong, the idea that this court would clarify or issue a precedential opinion on a child's residence. But your return to the definition of residence in 518.003 intrigues me, because it does refer to this intent to move. And I'm stuck with Judge Ross's earlier question to appellant's counsel. I'm just curious whether you've given it some thought. So whose intent are we looking at in that when we have a child? I mean, if you think that's a definition that we could rely on in this case, whether precedential or non-precedential, but just as persuasive authority, I mean, whose intent would we be looking at?
I think we would be looking at the parent's intent and the child's intent. I don't think you can divorce one from the other.
Does 518 suggest that a child's intent is relevant as to residence in child custody cases?
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
I don't think it does suggest that.
Is there any law that would suggest that? If you've got a runaway, I'm just trying to imagine a circumstance where the runaway's design or preference matters on the question of the legal question of where does this child reside. Assuming a runaway is against the running away is against the parent's will.
I think the parent's intent should be controlling. But in this case, I'm just arguing that there's a sufficiency challenge here, sufficiency of the evidence to venue. I'm pointing to the victim's testimony that this is what she believed. And I'm countering the argument that the victim intended to move out permanently. That's not what she testified to. But the mother also testified that she believed that the victim's home was, that her house was still her home and that she maintained this bedroom. So I think the parent is the overriding issue or the overriding interest. But in this case, I just think for purposes of the sufficiency challenge that her testimony is important. I'm out of time. I thank you for your time, and I ask this court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
I may begin just addressing a couple of points, Your Honor. I checked the question you had about the transferring of that. It was actually the January 29th order. After everything, after she was found, after the offense, the 20th order just says remove her from the home, take her to an appropriate caregiver. So that wasn't established on the January 20th order. The 518.003 subdivision.
So then, what's the import of that then? There was no residence at all at the time of the assault?
Well, no. As I've argued here, that there is a legal basis for concluding that her residence, albeit temporary, was in Benton County at Child B's home.
Let's assume that, I'm not saying this is what we do or what I think, but assume for this question that the parents will controls. If the child has always resided with mom, mom has not relinquished that intent for the child to live there. But your argument is, so that it doesn't matter that the child was wanting to live with a friend at that time. What matters is the parents, but your argument is that it's severed at the time of the January 20th order. Wouldn't that mean that there really is no residence under your definition?
Well, no, and I wanted to get back to the MGH decision in 518.03. I think respondents' reliance on subdivision 9 from 518.03 is misplaced. That refers to an adult's intention. See, the MGH court couldn't use subdivision 9, or they would have. That's why they turned to subdivision 3, that a child's residence is wherever they're living, where an adult or a caregiver has routine daily care and control. I mean, even without the January 20th order, Child A's mother didn't have that anymore. It was barred by a court order. So that's why the subdivision 9 can't apply here. Now, the district court, either in the pretrial hearings or in the post-conviction order, never actually provided any law on what a child residence is. There were cases cited like Dividner and El-Masri. Those dealt with an adult's intentions. The district court the post-conviction court cited 136A101 about tuition or 290.01 on income tax. That all relates to an adult. See, that is why this is why the legislature never addressed it, because they never thought of it either. So what happens if a child flees an abusive home? That's why I think the Berg case can be somewhat informative on that, because they said while Minnesota still had jurisdiction, if the child had fled or been abandoned and was living in North Dakota for any time, North Dakota would have jurisdiction. I think the law is designed to wrest parental control of a child's residence if that child flees that home, if they're not living there, that the district court's ongoing assumption that the parent's choice of residence is always the child's residence is not true. And I think that's how 627.15 was crafted, to deal with situations like this where a child may not be living with their parents anymore if they ran away for whatever reason.
There's a difference between a guest and a resident.
Certainly.
So is there any evidence that the victim was at the home of the friend was a place where the victim was more than a guest based upon any adult's testimony?
That she was a child, that there's no evidence she had anywhere to go besides that place. That's why El-Masri and Dividner don't apply here, because that's the same question they dealt with. Child A wasn't merely a guest. She needed care. She went to the home where there was an adult the way that the in loco parentis law works is that responsibility is assumed, however temporarily. That welfare of GM case I cited, a non-parent became in loco parentis just for a police interrogation for like 40 minutes. It's different with a child. And that's why the subdivision 9 can't apply here. On the advisory council issue, I think I lay it out well enough in my brief, but I think that the district court's application of 504 was incorrect, because the considerations about delay and attorney shopping are supposed to happen, after the council is appointed. And Mr. Sievers cited a basis for needing it, and as both the prosecutor and the district court recognized, they didn't think he wanted to just have a new attorney immediately. They both said, yeah, it's clear he wants to represent himself. So I failed to see a basis in the record, if 504 was properly followed, for him to have been denied advisory counsel. If that's an error that is found by this court, then that would require a new trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We very much appreciate hearing from counsel today. This matter is now submitted to the court for a decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you.